Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, guys.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome back to Pulse to the Wall, episode 55. And today we're joined by Pete Quinones. And Pete, I think you were on episode 5 or 6 of this podcast back when it was still called the Mike Paulcast. So this is really your Pulse to the Wall debut. Huge honor for you, I'm sure. So since that time, I mean, we've definitely got more experience. I think we were like booking guests that we never thought we could get in the first 5, 6 episodes. We had like Scott Horton, Gene Epstein, you, Stapleton, like all these big names. And we were definitely trying to walk before we could crawl, but I think we've kind of caught up there. So it's great to have you back on. And before we get into the serious stuff that we're going to be discussing, you were recently at Porkfest, and that's been an item on my bucket list for a few years. Can you tell us a little bit just about the event and, like, you know, what the vibe is, like what's all done there?
I mean, it's just laid back and wild. I mean, you have everybody from like left anarchists and hippie, I mean, like out look like hippies and things like that. And people like that, and everybody's just cool with each other. I mean, there's really no, you know, we didn't see any animosity. I mean, there was this thing that Nick Sarwak showed up and started to videotape Karen Ann Harlow's talk, like some weirdo wearing sunglasses or something like that. But I hadn't gotten there yet. And I would have just got a whole bunch of people together to stand in front of him so he couldn't do it and just harass him until he left. But it's mostly, I mean, it's really, it's a bunch of drinking, a bunch of partying, and a bunch of people hanging out, eating really good food and being chill with one another. You know, the only people that seemed to want to start problems were, you know, one person and, you know, shock of all shocks, who it would be. Yeah,
no kidding. And, you know, that's it sounds like a great time, like you just laid out. And we're going to be at Freedom Fest, which Dave Smith is hosting in a few, or I think like exactly a month from now. And Gene Epstein said that he's like, you know, Pork Fest and Freedom Fest are fun, but he thought Pork Fest was like more of a fun time. Like it was more like what you just described. So maybe next year we'll make it out there. And then there's Childerberg. So there's all these libertarian-ish events, even though maybe we can
I'll be at all those next year. I mean, definitely go. And this time I'm going to Pork Fest for the full week. I mean, it was just too much fun. You just have to watch out because, man, that alcohol catches up.
I experienced that at Childerberg, that Texas sun combined with, you know, chugging beers, it hits you
real quick.
Yeah. Wake up in the morning like, what happened to me?
Yeah. And then you have like that kind of like vacation drunk where you're just kind of in this haze the entire time. It's not like sober, tipsy, drunk, you know, it's kind of like one thing. But yeah. And then the other thing, just a quick comment. I mean, looking at some of the pictures that people were posting from there, I didn't realize how like beautiful New Hampshire is. I mean, there's like swooping hills.
No, the mountains. I mean, you're in the middle of the mountains there. I mean, it is, we took some pictures with, Dave and I took a picture with the mountains in the background. I got a picture with Reed Coverdale with the mountains in the background. And then when I posted them, people are just like, holy crap, look at that scenery. Yeah, those are mountains. Like when you're coming up 93 out of Boston, because I flew into Logan and flew Atlanta to Boston, you know, 2.5 hours, then drive 3 hours. Like at one point, 93, like this main highway goes through a national park and it is just mountains on both sides. And you see where the ski slopes are for when winter hits and everything. I mean, it is picturesque. I mean, it's beautiful up there. I could probably live there if I was a snowbird, like went to Florida or, you know, went south during the winter. But as beautiful as it is during the summer, and I'm sure it's beautiful during the winter, it's going to be cold as a mofo. And yeah, I'm just, these old bones are not, don't want that anymore.
Yeah, no kidding. But yeah, no, it was surprising to see. It's a well-kept secret. Maybe they want to like keep that. I think the story with Iceland and Greenland was they called Iceland because they didn't want people moving there. The very, very xenophobic reason, by the way. People think it's funny. I think it's really a knock. It's bad stuff. But anyway,
I've been to Iceland. It's nice.
Yeah,
I hear good things. Yeah. It's on the to-do list. I'm kind of waiting for the dust to settle on the stupidity with the travel restrictions right now before I do think about any international travel.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. I was going to ask you how was flying into Logan? Did you have to verify you were COVID free? Because I know Massachusetts is ridiculous.
Nah, there were people walking around. I mean, there were people walking around the airport without masks on.
Really?
I mean, they weren't getting yelled at or anything like that. In the Delta Sky Club, where they want you to keep your mask on when you're not eating or drinking, everybody had their mask off and was just laying back. I mean, except the obvious people that voted for Biden 10 times, you know, you could spot across the room.
Yeah.
That's awesome. But so getting into the topic of what we were bringing you on to talk today about is this recent wedge. And I know you have an episode coming up on your podcast. You mentioned before the show that you're going to cover in depth this week. Specifically, I wanted to talk about more about the ideas here. So this is something that if you would have, like, I would say a year ago, I had this kind of like shifting in my gut feeling that I hadn't felt since Ron Paul pulled me out of my trance, you know, 8 years ago. And I noticed that same feeling start to creep up. I think I first listened to Curtis Yarvin on Thaddeus Russell's podcast, and then again on your podcast, and it started articulating these kind of suspicions that I felt on like I said, a gut level. And then really about two, three months ago, I started feeling the same way. And like particularly regarding the Mises Caucus, where I started to look at sort of the futility of the end game. And this has been something that you've been talking about, people like Vin Armani or Cyprianus. I can't remember. Sorry. It's too soon. Cyprian. That's right. And Matt and those guys have been talking about. And it's really starting to sort of manifest in my mind where I'm trying to be objective here. I was very pro Mises Caucus as recently as a couple of months ago, but now I'm seeing it as not just, oh, if it fails, it fails, but that this is something that could be potentially very counterproductive. So if you could, and when you listen to the podcasts that have covered this recently, it's a lot of talking to distill some sort of abstract ideas. So if you had to tell somebody, like an elevator pitch, why this is a bad idea, how would you present that?
What, why I think, I mean, I struggle with it because I mean, I have so many friends in the Mises Caucus and I know that they're not doing anything for, to be harmful. I guess I've gotten to the point where I look around and see, like I just posted on Twitter, it's a license plate from Iowa and it says vax me up. So it's a vanity plate. And I look at things like that. I look at the last 16 months and I question whether the whole idea of putting out a bugle call for liberty on the biggest, you know, I mean, and especially under the libertarian banner. When you look at like Joe Jorgensen's appearance on Dave Rubin last year, and you know, she went on there and I mean, she made sense. It was just typical libertarianism crap. I mean, just your straight pablum basics. And, you know, the whole comment section is talking about her tweet about, you know, being actively anti-racist. And I mean, I just don't know that doing anything under the name libertarian anymore is going to bring in a lot of people, because I think that it's gotten to the point where most people know, even if they don't know what libertarianism is, they have an idea in their mind what libertarianism is. And once they have that idea in their mind, getting them to change that is hard. So I don't know that this whole restarting the Ron Paul revolution by having somebody run on a national stage, which is obviously not going to be a Republican stage like Ron did, is going to restart a revolution, taking into consideration the fact that it doesn't seem like people want liberty. It seems like people want chains. So is it counterproductive? I mean, is it counterproductive? I don't even really like that language. The question is it even worth it? Is it worth the time you'd put into it? The money you'd donate to it, the effort, is it going to work? And you know, I think that Matt more than Vin asks a really good question. Well, if it doesn't work, what do you do? If after 2024, you don't see this gigantic revolution that has restarted nationally, okay, well, what do you do? I mean, what are the excuses for it? Is it that we didn't have the right messenger? I mean, really, it's going to get to, it has to get to the point now where you have to ask, is it the messenger or the message? And it just may be that the message, the way it's been delivered for a long time now, that there was a time in 2007 and 2012 that a lot of people flocked to it. Maybe we're past that. Maybe COVID changed the game.
I've wondered that exact point. And, you know, there was also the economic crash, which was, you know, people, when they experience hardship, they look to change. And I think that even despite COVID, people are still pretty comfortable. You know, they still have their DoorDash. They still have their Netflix. They got stimmy checks coming in. So I don't know if people are going to be as receptive to it, because conditions haven't realized yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, yeah, you're seeing inflation, but that's only a little bit of talk about it.
I think Aaron from Timeline Earth said it best. He said it on a recent episode and I was hanging out with him the past couple of days. People haven't gotten hungry.
Yeah. Agreed.
And I know that you and Aaron have also proposed the idea of the goal of the Libertarian Party should just be a vehicle of radicalization. That should be the ultimate goal. And I generally believe that. I think if you're going to play to win, I think that Tho Bishop has offered, you know, the GOP is relatively fractured right now. And if you want to win on the political stage, use their war chest, use their resources. You know, I've talked with Nick about this. You could use the GOP and get 30 Thomas Massey types in there, or you can maybe get one LP House member and from the state of New Hampshire. I mean, which is going to make more difference?
Yeah. The radicalization is, it's a good idea, but I mean, it's not going to happen. You know, when you run automatically, when you run for an office and you are the mouthpiece for a party, a political party. I mean, really, how based are you going to get? I mean, seriously, I mean, it's not like, you know, they're going to become the Bolsheviks, you know, where they're going to start preaching fire and brimstone and, you know, making threats. So, I mean, I don't know how it helps. And I do, you know, I think that if the Mises Caucus, their whole goal was localization, just concentrate on doing things locally, moving the needle locally, which I think is something that can be done. I honestly think it is something that can be done, you know, depending on locations, locales, things like that. I mean, some local parties and some locales are as corrupt as the national. But, you know, you can research and figure out where you can make the needle move locally. But the whole idea of, you know, and getting Angela in his chair, I think that would be good because, you know, she's about localization. She's about partnering with people locally, even people you don't agree with, you know, to get one specific goal done, which is a good political idea, something that a political party should do. I don't know how much the idea, and it seems that everybody's hedging their bets on the Ron Paul revolution being rekindled. I don't know that that's going to happen. I don't know that. I look at the last 16, 17 months and I see a lot of people who are upset. I see a lot of people who, well, and let's talk about the election a little bit, that believe the election was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Libertarian Party and, you know, some of the people at the top of the party were calling. I mean, Nick Sarwak still calls. And I know he's not part of the party anymore, but he's still a former chair and has some influence when he talks in public. He still wants January 6th insurrection because he hates the right more than the left. Okay. So, I mean, he's just blue pill. And, you know, you had a party that did not speak out against the lockdowns, did not question whether the vote in 2020 for president was legitimate or not. And that's what all these people that you want to reach out to care about is the lockdowns, the vote, you know, whether the vote was legitimate or not. And the libertarians have not said anything about it. And now you want to come in late and start appealing to them. I don't know. I think that people get it in there. Once most people, you know, who are, let's face it, they're stupid. They're idiots. Okay. The average person is just an idiot who just wants to be safe. Doesn't want to learn anything new. You know, I mean, still listens to the same music they listened to in high school. Guilty. you know, I mean, who are you trying to get? I mean, the young people all want socialism or some kind of, you know, some kind of government handouts and everything. Mm-hmm. I don't see the strategy in going out there and doing that, especially when you ask the question, what if it fails miserably? Because if it fails miserably, I will honestly say any kind of libertarian wing of the libertarian, like say the Mises Caucus in 2022 in Reno next year, Angela gets in the chair, pretty much everyone's Mises Caucus. And then you go into 2024, you run, say Dave runs, okay, for president. And it's to put that liberty message out there to reignite the Ron Paul revolution. And you have all these people who came together to do it. They all went to Reno in 2022. They're all going to go to the DC convention in 2024 to get Dave out there preaching the message. And the message fails. How many of those people are sticking around?
That's a good question.
And what do they do? Well, what happened after 2012? People after the Ron Paul revolution in 2012, people stood around for a while. A lot of the people who supported Ron Paul, they went Trump, some went alt-right, I mean, where are they going to go now?
Let me ask you this, because we've been talking about this on the podcast, I mean, for the past couple months, of what the strategy should be. And it seems like the route of having this ideological purity in an age where we're living in an age of populism seems like just the completely wrong approach. And I think, like Tyler mentioned, Tho Bishop's strategy of using the GOP, and Eric Brakey's done the same thing. It seems like if there's any strategy, it's to kind of inject our ideas into that existing populism that's out there right now. I mean, like you said, you could talk to people about the lockdowns, about the inflation that they're going to see. I mean, that's our bread and butter as people who come from, like, having studied Austrian economics. These are things that are going to be very relevant. So as far as messaging, I like the idea that the Mises Caucus has, which is get the word out to as many people as possible, get popular support. Can't be a bad thing. But when I look at the Mises Caucus, like, it's I've been trying to distill how I feel about this. I think I admire everybody that's in the party or that's in the caucus. Like, you look at Angela McArdle and Michael Heiss and all these people, and they're, like, very, like, good-hearted, knowledgeable people. But I think that the Mises Caucus by itself is not greater than the sum of its parts. You know, like, these people are better off using other strategies and vehicles to get their ideas, their policies through, than this one thing that seems destined to fail.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think but I also, when it comes to the Mises Caucus, I separate the two strategies. One is the local strategy and one is the national strategy. Mm-hmm. I still support them on the local strategy. I mean, why wouldn't I? I mean, it's the one that makes the most sense. I don't know about the national strategy. It just doesn't seem like it's going to work to me. I want it to work. I want there to be like a, you know, see this revival, you know, 1800s Christian type revival of libertarianism, you know, 1776, something that would go back to the founding. We hold these truths to be self-evident kind of thing. I don't know. I don't know that people, you know, you have to, you know your audience. When it comes to sales, they tell you to know your audience. When I look at the audience, I don't know what I see there that is that this message is going to be, you know, and the Fed. Okay, that's great. Okay. I mean, people don't really, I mean.
Most people don't even know what the Fed is.
Yeah, and the war. Yeah, and the wars. Okay. Most people don't know that we're in 9 countries. Now, when you tell them, they're just like, oh, I guess, you know, that have to be there. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the national strategy is. I mean, I know what the local strategy is. It makes sense to me. You know, I've talked about recently, I don't know whose show I was on, but I think I might have been talking with Adam Patrick, and that you can easily like take over a town. Like, even like by force. You know, you could take over my hometown. You could take over by force. You could probably do it in a day, maybe less. And because there's a mayor, you know, a bunch of cops, like 10 people on the board, you get control of them. What happens? You have the town. Okay. What are you going to do about the government? What are you going to do about the federal government? 2.4 million employees. No one knows who's in charge. I mean, you know, if you read the Machiavellians, if you read various political books, you know that the elites are in charge. Most people don't even know who those elites are. I probably don't know who those elites are. You know, I mean, people running the government, really running the government, we've probably never heard their names because they're in the background. I mean, why would they become politicians when they can wield power anonymously? I don't know. I don't know that you're ever going to be able to get that percentage of people that it's going to take to change the culture. And that's really what you have to do, is you have to change the culture. And that's what it comes down to. And you do that locally. You do that locally. You start with your own culture locally. And, you know, if people want to, you know, hey, get government out of schools, well, it's like Hoppe said, you start locally.
Yeah. And, you know, this is something I kind of share with you, a view where I know you've talked about how you're white pilled one day, black pilled the next day. Mm-hmm. And for me, the case for the white pill is that the kind of decentralizing route seems to be the natural course right now. We see people fleeing California, New York, and going to Texas and Tennessee and Florida. And I mean, is that why you say you're white pilled some days? The fact that people seem to be doing this just organically, getting up and moving, voting with their feet and forming local communities?
Yeah, there seems to be some federalism involved. I don't necessarily think decentralization is a good thing or a bad thing. I think in very small areas, it's a good thing. The fact that the national government is the way it is because it's radically decentralized. I mean, there's no central force. There's no, you know, there's no king. So what happens, you know? Okay, so we're going to make this guy the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Agriculture, and, you know, the Secretary of Defense. What are people's reactions to that going to be? Well, we can't have the guy who's in charge of war being in charge of our food. We need somebody else. And you just grew government.
Right.
Because
right.
Now we have to have a bunch of different departments because there has to be a specialist here. That's Burnham's book, The Managerial Revolution, talks about that, where we have to have managers for everything. And that's the way government grows. So when you're talking about decentralization, you also have to define your terms, because nationally decentralized means the biggest government in the history of mankind. You know, if there was a king, maybe it wouldn't be that big, because he'd have what, a couple of advisors, and you know, only people that he would trust, people that he would, you know, trust not to put a bullet in him.
You know? Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I am calling for a king. I don't care. I'm not. I don't know what would work with this culture. You look at this culture and you just have to ask, okay, what would be the best way to manage or rule over this culture and give people the most liberty? Well, people don't want liberty. They give it away.
They gladly give it away. And I've had conversations with, in like a group chat with a few of us about, you know, advocating for liberty and like individual responsibility and like you're in control of your own destiny. Like, it's hard to sell that. It's hard to sell accountability and the effort it takes to maintain it when victimhood is and government handouts are always around the corner. You know, people see, they're like, well, you know, look at all the social movements going on in this country right now. They're almost all of them are based in some form of victimhood. And then, you know, you can get the clicks on social media. You post a black square on Instagram and 500 people like it. You know, victimhood sells, and that's what we're competing against. And you touched on it a little bit earlier that, you know, libertarians want to hold themselves as purity test. They want to say, I'm principled, but you're facing an enemy that doesn't have principles. They will change their principles a week from now. How do you beat that? You can't sell, you know, the people aren't receptive to it, because what you're selling requires a paradigm shift, and it requires real effort to maintain it, where you can, you know, continue going along to get along. Yeah, you might bitch about your property taxes, but you got DoorDash, you got Netflix, you got Facebook, you know, you don't have to maintain anything. You just have to go to work, come home, have a few beers, eat dinner, and go to sleep.
Yeah, I think you said it earlier right there was, when we talk about liberty, we use that term, really, there's no using that term without using the term responsibility. Because if people aren't responsible, if people aren't going to take responsibility over their lives, there is no liberty. There is not going to be liberty. And not on a mass scale. There are places in this country where there are people who, you know, believe in personal responsibility, groups of people. I mean, it's rare. You're not going to find it near a city. That's for sure. Which is why people are returning to going more rural. And yeah, I mean, if we're not mentioning responsibility in with liberty, then that mess, you're only delivering half the message. And when you, and if you do decide to deliver the whole message, which is liberty, but it's also responsibility, then the majority of people aren't going to want it because people don't want responsibility. So yeah. where do we go from here? I mean, so that is the question, is where do we go from here?
Yeah. And that's something talking about responsibility. I know that's in kind of the podcast circle. That's been a theme that's been talked about a lot recently. But at the same time, I think that that's sort of why Jordan Peterson had his meteoric rise. There seems to be some sort of hunger for that message as well. And I honestly, having this idea in my head now, I'm kind of embarrassed that I never thought of it before, but there is that huge link between liberty and responsibility. And I think a big part of the failure of spreading the message has been not incorporating those two together, not presenting them as the same thing. And I think Matt made that, I think it was Matt that made that point on the Liberty Lockdown episode, but he made that case really well. And yeah, I mean, I hope that maybe that idea has a way of getting through, but then, I mean, we're having like a really abstract conversation. And what I'm trying to put together in my head is where rubber meets road, what does that actually look like? And we just don't know yet.
And that's the thing, is when you come to the realization that you can't have liberty without responsibility, and the overwhelming majority of the population and the culture doesn't want responsibility, then you need to backtrack and go, okay, we need to rethink what we're doing here. Especially when, like you guys said, when the people in charge have no principles. They will change them at the drop of a hat so that they can get their way. And then, you know, libertarians, because libertarians are the smartest people and the most consistent people in the room, aren't willing to bend or play the games that the other ones are playing because, you know, then, hey, then I'll be a statist or I'll be, you know, whatever other social media, you know, fantasy and Capistan warrior wants to call you. And, you know, if you're going to play politics, I mean, you can be somebody who sits at home, shit posts on social media. I do it a lot.
I love it, for the record.
Well, I also have a strategy when I'm doing it. I'm not just doing it to get I'm doing it to get reactions, but I'm doing it to get reactions for a purpose. And then what else is there? What's the praxis? And that's what it comes down to. As insufferable as the agorists are, I mean, worse than vegans, worse than free staters, at least they have a plan. At least they're doing something, you know? And that's why, I mean, like I said, as insufferable as they are most of the time, a lot of them, at least they're doing something. At least they see a praxis and they're working with it. They see a practical solution to it. And they're going for it. And it's kind of hard to piss on them for it. But the whole idea that all we're going to do is preach. Yeah, I mean, think about the history of Christianity. Okay, so you had the Great Commission, go forth and preach Christ to all the lands. And, well, yeah, they did that. But they also had work. They also, like, fed the poor. They also did things that attracted people who didn't believe to them. Well, I mean, pretty much it's, and what's funny is in doing that, you're showing, by serving people, you're showing people what Christ did, how he served in his life when he was alive. And that goes back to Matt saying that Christian, or I don't know who said it, but libertarianism is Christianity without Christ. And that's what it is you're going forth and you're preaching this message, but nobody sees you living that message or providing a practical solution for it. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a mess. It's a message without a, without anything to work with it, without anything in way to make it happen with your hands.
Yeah. And you were talking, you touched on the political strategy where, you know, the people who win, the powerful, are willing to play dirty Machiavellian politics, and principled libertarians aren't willing to do it. So you're left with just whatever bully pulpit you have trying to spread your message and purity with. But I mean, the analogy I like to use is, you know, people, we'll just say right-leaning conservatives and libertarians, they view politics and political theater as, like, if we're going to use a fighting analogy, they know that it's presented as if it's a sanctioned, like regulated MMA fight with judges and an objective referee. And then they know that their opponents play dirty. They know that they play dirty, and they know that the refs and the judges are bought and paid for, but they still go in and fight with their principles when it's not a fair fight. And then afterwards they complain about it. And it's almost worse that they have this, that they know that the other side, their opponents, the cathedral, are playing dirty, and they engage anyway, not ready to deal with it. So they view it as a sport, where if you view it as a martial art, you go in there with the mindset of, okay, I know that they're going to play dirty. I know that it's not fair. You better have a strategy to deal with it, or you don't. And bitching about it isn't going to do anything.
Well, and you know, and if they are coming in there to play dirty, most of the time when someone's playing dirty, you have to play dirty back. Are you ready to do that? Because mm-hmm. it's going to go against your principles. An article that I wrote for my Substack late last year, why the Libertarian Party will never have political power. And it was just basically the non-aggression principle. It's you're sticking to this thing about, oh, we're not going to sink to the level that others sink to. It was like when I caught a bunch of shit for that tweet about, well, just go in with guns to and take the stuff back in New Hampshire.
I remember
and
that.
People got all upset about it and everything. And I'm like, well, they violated the non-aggression principle. If they violated the non-aggression principle by stealing your stuff, go take it back. I mean, that's what if somebody breaks the non-aggression principle, like, all bets are off, right? And that's what I've been hearing ever since I became a libertarian. So, yeah, I mean, that even made it into the evidence folder of, you know, how toxic the Mises Caucus was getting. And it's like, what's funny is there's no Mises Caucus membership. It's like, I guess, oh, you're Mises Caucus and everything. It's like, I don't know, prove it, you know?
Yeah.
There's no membership. I mean, you know, whatever.
I feel like it's a Joe Biden, like, here, it's an idea, you know?
Yeah. You know, so... I never, you know, so if people are going to play dirty, you have to be ready for it. And yeah, I mean, what does that look like? I mean, you should be ready for everything. I mean, what is it? You know, Sun Tzu said something about, you know, the only war you go into is one you know you're going to win. Mm-hmm. That means you have to know all sides. You have to. You have to know everything. And I know he also said something about, you know, anyone who goes to war is already lost or something like that. But he also said, if you could, you know, only go into a war that you know you're going to win, only go into a fight you know you're going to win. So you should know everything that could possibly be done. And I don't know that libertarians are ready for that. I don't know that they're ready to play that dirty for the most part. You know, I mean, the Libertarian Party, Mises Caucus, gets all this crap about being Nazis, about being entryists, about this. And man, I go into that Facebook group and I'm just like, man, where'd all these normies come from? I'm like, dude, it's like, I mean, like, wait a minute, Nazis? These guys aren't half as radical as I would, you know, like, I mean, not, some of them aren't radical at all. They think this is all going to be done with politics, and you know, you're going to be getting, I mean, libertarians last year, and I'm not talking about prags. I'm talking about libertarians of all stripes. I saw Facebook groups that were explaining how Joe Jorgensen was going to win.
Yeah.
And people liking and getting 200 likes on that post, 200 thumbs up on that post. And I'm just like, what is wrong with you? No libertarian's ever going to win. They're never going to allow it. And if you think
they won't even let him on the debate stage.
Yeah. Even if you thought, even if you thought it could happen in 2020 after the election, you know that it's not going to happen, because basically what I learned out of 2020 election politics is that the person who's going to win is the person that they want to win. That's the way it's going to be going forward from now on. There'll be Republican presidents. They'll be pro-Israel, pro-cops, pro-drug war. They're going to be handpicked. Yeah, you're not going. You're going. You'll have a choice of a bunch of Republicans, but all of those choices will be made for you. Mm-hmm. So no matter which one you pick, you're getting the one they want.
Yeah, you can have it at any color as long as it's black, right? The old Henry Ford quote.
Yeah.
But So this is a question I wanted to ask you. A couple books in this kind of counter libertarian idea, I'll call it. I just coined that we've seen over the last year with, Yarvin and, Vin Armani and Matt and you has been like the Burnham's Machiavellians. You could throw a couple other books in there that have really been influential. And then Yarvin's whole Unqualified Reservations. But on the topic of strategy, this is something I've been exploring lately. And you just talked about Sun Tzu. And I also recently read Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, which is very enlightening when you actually read it. I mean, it's crazy. And the other one is Miyamoto Musashi's The Book of Five Rings, which is similar to The Art of War. They're both viewed as like these historically significant strategy books. So I noticed that one thing with libertarians is they get very caught in these echo chambers of reading just Mises and Rothbard and Hoppe. And those are all very knowledgeable people. So you're getting a lot of outside influences through osmosis. But do you think that's something that's like sorely lacking in this community, is reading like other books and other thinkers to also supplement the ideas?
I mean, there's like 4 or 5 libertarian books you could read and understand the ideology.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to be, you know, Yarvin talks about how he was like a completionist with Mises and Rothbard, and he just read everything. And you don't have to do that. I mean, yeah, he's a machine. So to think that you need to do that to understand the ideology is ridiculous. I mean, 4 or 5 books. But then, find me a libertarian book by a libertarian author who understands political power and the history of political power like James Burnham. Just doesn't exist. There's no book out there that's going to explain how the elites take over and how they're always in charge. I mean, it sounds like conspiracy theory stuff, but it's true. I mean, you can look at it through Burnham starts with the Medicis and just come straight forward. And, books like that, or books, you know, any book on like right-wing philosophy or left-wing philosophy. And, you know, like, I know like a lot of libertarians have read the Communist Manifesto. It's Communist Manifesto's garbage. I mean, he wrote it assuming that you were a communist. So somebody who's not a communist reading it is like, oh, this is garbage. Well, yeah, because you don't have the frame of reference to read it. Go read The German Ideology by Marx, and then read the Communist Manifesto, and then you'll understand exactly what he was doing, especially if you understand the 1800s and what was going on at that time in Europe. Read Julius Evola, some like hardcore right wingers and stuff like that, and see what you get out of that. And people just don't want to do it. The thing that I've come to learn about the libertarian ideology, and the reason I can say this is because I was so guilty of it for so many years, is that people just love to climb into these books, get them in their head, create Ancapistan in their head, And then if they're having a conversation about anything in reality, they run it through the filter of Ancapistan. And if it isn't in Ancapistan, it's statist and they don't want to talk about it. Well, then you're just an uneducated fool, because we live in reality. And the reality is that politics is important. Knowing politics is important. I mean, some people can just drop out. I mean, if you move someplace that's remote or something, and you're just like, okay, maybe all this stuff isn't going to touch you. Okay, that's fine. That's not most people. So most people are ignorant. And I'm talking about like some of the most well-read ANCAPs and libertarians. I mean, they don't have a functioning understanding of, you know, like when I talk about how the government, the United States government being so decentralized, that's the reason why it's that big. They have no clue what I'm talking about. I mean, they can't get it through their mind, because decentralization, good, centralization, bad, and United States government centralized. Well, that's not true. That's not true at all. It's not centralized. I mean, power is centralized, but power, I don't even know if power is centralized. I don't know where the power is in the government. I mean, to me, the government, to me, the power, when people ask me, like, they're like, oh, so where's the political power? I'm like, your local cop. Your local cop is the political power. He is just following orders and not questioning them for a paycheck and a pension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you mentioned that idea, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, when you were mentioning that idea, that was actually the first time I'd heard that decentralized on the federal level means bigger government. That, I mean, it clicked right away. I'm like, oh, I've never thought of it that way. But then, like, you think of things like a few years ago, I think Rogan actually had this in one of his specials, where he talked about how the FBI and the CIA were like playing dirty against each other, and they were like fucking each other over and trying to dig up dirt. And, you know, there's the old idea that don't interrupt your enemies when they're fighting each other. Mm-hmm. But part of me is like, wait a minute, that's not good, because now you have like several agencies, and that truly is decentralized. They're not part of the same central structure going at it. So that is cause for concern. Now that, when you said that, that was literally the first time I've thought about it in that way, but it makes sense.
I saw the same thing in Afghanistan too. Like Scott Horton laid it out in Fool's Errand. They had different organizations all funding different people, and they're all fighting each other. And then like Pakistan would get mad at us, be like, oh, sorry. We'll go find these guys, leave you guys out of it. That's not centralized, because if it was centralized, that wouldn't be happening.
If it was centralized, everybody would be on the same page, and everybody's not on the same page. That's like the whole thing about in the New World Order. The Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission and the World Economic Forum, they're all in it together. If they were all in it together, we'd like literally be living in pods now. We'd be in the Matrix, and they'd just be using us as batteries. But they're not, because they're not all in it together. That's decentralized. I mean, the World Economic Forum having all these things and disagreeing with each other, you know? It's funny, the centralization, once you really start thinking about it, centralized powers would be preferable, because you know who is making the decisions.
Yeah. And
really knows who's making the decisions.
Yeah. That's the other thing, is it creates a new layer of problems, because if your message was government bad, the state is bad, right? You use the state in the singular sense, then you can say, okay, here's the enemy. This is what we have to, you know, either limit or abolish or whatever. And, but if you have, like you talked about the elites, how they're always in control. It's plural. There are many elites. So what is the message you're going to go hunt down, you know, metaphorically in Minecraft or whatever, hunt down all of these elites, and start checking their power. But if there's that many of them, then it seems like that's more of a systemic problem. Like that is something that's kind of baked into the cake of social hierarchy. So that is really an idea that needs to be grappled with inside these circles.
Yeah. I mean, and when you think about these people, so you can get many people to go, oh, look at everybody at Bilderberg. Those are the people who run the world. Really? How do you know? How do you know that they're not just a face job? How do you know there's not people behind them who are running things? Why? Because they have three commas, you know, in front in their bank account. They don't know that. I mean, they just get. I mean, we've seen over the last year and a half that they can just give people billions of dollars. You know, who knows how people have made their money? I mean, look at Jeff Bezos. All that money that he has, that they say he has, is from CIA contracts. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I mean, yeah, that almost seems like a gift half the time. So yeah, being decentralized, you know, if we knew the one person, you know, and then there's always, you know, Jacob Rothschild running around and, you know, everybody jumping in his face when he's in public. And I think it's hilarious that he just goes into public.
Yeah.
Like, he'll just like walk down the street. And it's just, and people are like yelling at him, and he's like, hey, how you doing?
He doesn't give a shit.
How you doing, slave? I mean, who knows he's in charge? I mean, who the fuck knows? I mean, when it comes down to it, what we should be studying now is we should be studying people. We should be looking at what people, how do we talk to people? How do you, okay, so what do people want? And if they want something that's the opposite of what we want, well, how do we build what we want so that we can avoid what they want? It seems like that's what should be done at this point, you know, and as, you know, as Matt has talked about, is build wealth. The more personal wealth you have, the more you're, you know, you don't have to worry about these things. You can buy your way out of situations. You can buy a politician. He's been talking. I know that that's like driven libertarians and ANCAPs crazy when he says that and everything, but I'm like, yeah. I mean, if I wanted something in my town to be done and I knew the person who could actually get it done, the one person who has like the most sway, you know, the whip or something on the local board, on the local board, why wouldn't I buy them?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
You know, it makes sense to me. I mean, you know, but oh, that's very unlibertarian. Well, it's very real world. It's very, mm-hmm. you know, it's reality. You know, are we allowed to play in reality, or are we only allowed to live in fantasy in our heads?
Well, and I think that, you know, I know that you've taken a lot of flack for supporting, you know, some of the nullification efforts that like state governors have done recently. You know, like I saw people calling Ron DeSantis an authoritarian, but it's like, if he's putting things in the policy and then making them law in the state that are generally good for people that are more liberty, or we'll say right-wing oriented, that's a good thing. And it should be encouraged, you know, because what's the other, you know, the libertarians, the purists want to bitch about the other way too. So it's like, which do you want? Sometimes you got to play with the cards you're dealt.
Well, and the great thing, and this is where nobody understands strategy, they just understand theory, is when DeSantis does something like that, I want to see what the polls say. What do the polls in Florida say? How many people polled? What's the percentage of people who agree with him doing this? That gives you a really good gauge of how many people are like maybe liberty leaning or responsibility leaning. You know, so why would you not want to see chaos in the short term? I mean, I don't really honestly believe him banning critical race theory is going to have people stop teaching it, or it's really going to stop it, or vaccine passports or whatever. But how are people reacting to it? I mean, what do they say about sales? Sales is all about people. It's you're basically selling yourself to somebody, and they'll buy your product if you can sell yourself to them properly. The same thing in politics. I mean, if your message is going to land, you want to know as much background about the people you're talking to as possible. And that goes with sales too. I mean, you're not going to call a 30-year-old about life alert things around their neck. You're going to call somebody who's 65. That's just knowing who your audience is. And libertarians don't want to hear it, because Murray Rothbard wrote For a New Liberty. And if you read that, it shows you what Ancapistan is. And that's where I'm living in my head. I got For a New Liberty up here. And, you know, if it's anything outside of For a New Liberty, well, that's statism, and you're a statist, and I get to call you that on social media. And it was just absolutely insane. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you talk about like reading For a New Liberty, that in particular, I've been hardcore obsessed with all of these thinkers for the last 5 years, and I've never read it because it seems really dense and boring, and it's just not going to happen. Like, so the idea that we're going to get the masses to start reading Anatomy of the State is just a pipe dream. It's I'm very quickly, like we said, the last year, realizing how futile that endeavor is. So, I mean, I'm with you. I think there almost needs to be a new word created for what we're talking about right now, because mm-hmm. it seems to be like, this is not traditional libertarianism in any sense. That was already a fractured, very muddy watered term to begin with. But now, like, the entire strategy being called into question, it seems like there needs to be a new like name or something describing this, because we need to have some sort of galvanizing of what we're talking about. And I think that's what's been interesting lately, is listening to these podcasts, the one that you're going to have this week to discuss it. And right now it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. I mean, I just joined Twitter, started actually using it about a week ago, and I joined at a great time because it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I know.
No, it's been fun. Like, Twitter, I understand it. I always just put it off like, yeah, whatever. I got Facebook. I don't need another app. But then you get on there and you see the mudslinging, and it's like, oh, this is a good time.
Oh, yeah. But I like the term post-libertarianism. It conjures it. A lot of people like it. It's also going to make people insane, because, you know, people think of postmodernism when they, you know, throw in a post in front of everything. And I like people to go insane and watch the way they react. But what was the other thing you were talking about?
The message, like the kind of galvanizing
Here was something I wanted to say. Believe me, this whole thing with, you know, running a really good libertarian candidate and trying to restart the Ron Paul revolution, I want that to work. I want it to work. Same. And I will. And if it doesn't work, I will be the first person to say I was wrong. I mean, and that I'm happy that it's working. I just don't think it will. I'm not at this time. You know, nothing that I've seen, especially in the last, you know, year and a half, lets me believe that it'll work, but I want it to. I think it'd be awesome. But that still does not solve the problem of the fact that the overwhelming majority of people do not want responsibility and do not want liberty. They want slavery. They proved it to you. And then you have, there's certain libertarians who are like, well, we need to appeal to the left. It's like, well, I mean, why? They're insane. They're nuts. Even the ones that aren't like woke, they're neoliberals. And they hate us. They hate everything about us. You know, so mm-hmm. you know, appeal to the neoliberal center. Yeah, you should be appealing to the freaking disaffected Trump supporter or anyone like that. Anyone on the right who's just, you know, blackpilled at this point. You know, and you might even have to blackpill them a little more in the interim. You know, one of my favorite things to tell people, you know, say is, man, if you believe the 2020 election got stolen, what do you think is going to happen in 2024? You think they're going to let, you know, if Trump runs again in 2024, you think they're going to let him win? They stole the election in 2020, right? They're not going to do it again in 2024? And just blackpill the hell out of them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like I said at Porkfest, then teach them economics. And then give them economics in one lesson and try and get it. I mean, economics is the answer to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Economics is the answer. I mean, as soon as somebody understands economics, as soon as somebody understands like what's in economics in one lesson, and they like apply it to their life, and then they start reading, start getting a little deeper into economics, that person's red pilled. They're not going to be blue. They're not going to be blue pilled. So they're red pilled. Yeah.
Tyler and I were talking before you hopped onto the chat here before the podcast. I was just listening to Russell Brand on Ben Shapiro's podcast, because sometimes I'm just a glutton for punishment. And that sounds like a wild. Yeah. Well, they were talking, and Russell Brand, I always thought he's like, he's just kind of blue pilled. He's kind of like the real life Ali G. You know, he has like the exact same accent. And so Yeah, no, they were talking, and Russell Brand is talking about how he's skeptical of power, and I'm listening to him talk. And then, you know, he said his only difference with people like libertarians and conservatives is that, you know, he believes that the powerful, the elite have a responsibility to provide for the poorer people. And the whole time I'm thinking, I'm like, wow, I never liked Russell Brand, but if he just understood, like if he read one good economics book, like you said, Hazlitt, he would be red-pilled. I mean, that's it. Like he would be right there with us if he just understood like that thing, like the way he talks about how, you know, live and let live. He doesn't want to bother anybody. He just thinks that we have a responsibility to take care of each other. And, you know, the way to do that, we would try to argue to him, is to have, you know, a free market economy. But yeah, no, I think you're onto something there.
Well, let me ask you a question. This is going to be the most unlibertarian thing I say. If we agree that the elites are always going to be in charge, is he wrong?
That we have a responsibility to take care of the less fortunate?
That the elites have a responsibility to take care of the less fortunate.
Oh, that is a good question. I mean, ultimately, no, I don't think directly, anybody has.
It would have to be direct. They would have to directly do it, not use a middleman, not use taxation, you know, but directly be the one responsible for the poor. Because yeah, and it would probably be them who were part of the reason they were poor. But I'm not like one of those people who believes that there wouldn't be poor people. Not everyone's equal. You're always going. Right. Even Jesus said you're always going to have the poor. So
yeah. No, I mean, if you look at like, let's try to put this in real world terms. If you look at the rising cost of housing and how that's going to be causing, you know, homelessness, you know, a lack of supply of housing, it's, you know, lower than demand warrants. So we're going to see like, let's say an increase in homelessness, some guy who would have otherwise afforded a house if they didn't artificially pump up and boost the market. Do the people at the Fed have a responsibility to that guy that's now sitting out in the rain, you know, overnight? I think you could make a compelling argument that yes, they do. I don't know how to administer that. I think that's a whole other conversation, but it's a good thought experiment.
Yeah. You'd have to forgive a bunch of debt. You'd have to, and you know, I mean, they'd just have to look at the debtor, you know, the people who buy the debt overseas and tell them to go screw themselves, that they're never going to get paid back, things like that. But yeah, I mean, I remember back, last summer, or even before last summer, when you know, we're making arguments, I was making the argument that, I mean, if the government put you out of work, the government owes you restitution.
Yes, that's very direct.
And I mean, there were the living in Ancapistan in their head, libertarians who that blows their mind, because you're going to destroy your children and your grandchildren's future because they're just going to print that money. They're going to print it anyway. I mean, right. What you're trying to do is you're trying to preserve this system. Is that what you're saying? You're trying to preserve this system. Cause that's what it sounds like. Unless you think the system can be fixed. And if you think the system can be fixed, I don't think you understand what $30 trillion is. Because $1 trillion is $1 million million. Okay? It's $1 million one time. $1 million 1 million times. Push that out to 30. I read an article in 2008, 2009-ish, and it explained mathematically how the debt at that time, which I think was 15 or 16 trillion, it could be lower than that. It could have been 12. Could never be paid back. And yet people think that now that it's going to 30 trillion, that they're somehow going to preserve the system. And if any of these people are like crypto enthusiasts, they're out of their friggin' minds. I mean, you want the system to fail, right? You want to have, you want your pet cryptocurrency to be able to rise up and become currency that would be widely adopted. I mean, I don't really understand the whole, I have to do, if I deviate one step away from this straight line that is called libertarianism and anarcho-capitalism. I'm a statist, and the worst thing I could be called in the world is a statist. I don't give a anymore.
I get it, because that was me 2 years ago. It really was.
Yeah, me too. Like, the reason I can be so passionate about this is I was the same thing. I was somebody who was like, culture doesn't matter. Oh, no, no. And now I'm like, everything is culture.
It's everything.
It's everything. Yeah. You change the culture, then you can have, you have to change the culture in, think about it. We're talking about responsibility, right? How would you get people to be more responsible? You would literally have to change the culture of the people.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, and I was there. That's why it's so frustrating to me, because when I'm being mad at somebody who doesn't see it, I'm being mad at myself 2 years ago too. You know, I'm beating myself up a little bit too, you know, for not being able to see that.
Yeah. You
know, and I think too, like when you and Aaron started discussing like reading like State and Revolution, when I first heard that, I'm like, oh fuck no. Like no, like, you know, I was that like, I'm never, you know, commies are always wrong, this and that. And then I was like, okay, fine. I'll give it a go. And I was like, okay, I can kind of see where he's coming from. Like, I think they understood some things. You know, maybe the end goal wasn't, we deviated at the end goal, but there's, I think there's a ton to be learned.
Yeah, when Aaron and I were hanging out at Porkfest and everything, we had to have the discussion around all the anarchists about how, you know, they killed the anarchists, but they kind of had to, because the anarchists were retarded. I mean, the anarchists were terrible. They were like, oh, we're just going to overthrow the society. And then, you know, we'll just we'll let the government collapse. And then what's going to happen? The same elites that own the government are just going to buy everything back, and they're going to raise it back up. And Lenin understood that. He explains it in State and Revolution. And it came straight from Engels, where, you know, that's why the whole collapsitarian thing to me is not viable, because sure, okay, there are some collapsitarians who are like, okay, if it collapses, we're going to close off this section of property and everything like that. And now we're going to be whatever, Libre Land, whatever you want to call it. All right, good luck with that.
I mean, Pete, did you listen to Michael Malice on Jordan Peterson's podcast?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
So going into that, I mean, I was waiting for it to drop for a couple months. Like, I was just waiting. I was like just checking my podcast feed every day, just waiting for it, because I knew it would be great fun to hear, you know, Jordan Peterson talking to Michael Malice, and it would be a great time. And
you have to do Kermit the Frog anyways.
So. yeah, right. Before we wrap up, I got a quick funny story about that. So when I was listening to that, when they started talking about anarchy, you have two very brilliant, like high IQ people talking about this. And the whole time I didn't find Malice's message particularly compelling, you know, defending anarchy. And I didn't think Peterson was asking great questions either. He was kind of, they were both being very abstract, which is necessary to a degree when talking about anarchy. But that was another thing where it kind of pushed me away a little bit. I never got to the point of calling myself an anarchist, even though that was, I like Larry Sharp's description of it. He said, you know, anarcho-capitalism is the North Star. Like, ideally, that's what you're aiming for. But yeah, listening to that, I didn't think Malice came off great. I mean, what are your thoughts on that podcast?
I don't know. It's Peterson was, I think it's hard to, I've been interviewed by some people who aren't really good interviewers, and I'm sure I came off like sounding like an idiot because of it. He just, I don't know. It didn't, I've heard better defenses of anarchy by Malice before.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it had a lot to do with Peterson. I think that, I don't think he was ready for that. I just don't think he's knows anything about anarchist thinkers and knows anything about anarchist history. So I think it's hard for, you know, for a Peterson to do that. Also, I also think it's very rare that Jordan Peterson comes up against somebody whose IQ is as high, you know, is high or higher than his. So I thought my impression of that interview overall was I was very unimpressed by Jordan Peterson in that interview.
Yeah, he's not the same.
yeah, that was not my I didn't come away with that going, okay, did Malice defend anarchy well? I came away with that going, this Peterson guy, I mean, this wasn't very impressive. And I'm sure he has some, I don't listen to his podcast. I never really understood the appeal, maybe because I am somebody who is responsible. And, you know, when I read the 12 Steps book, I mean, it was all just logical to me and stuff that I've been doing, you know, my whole life. So,
yeah, I guess I could. To me. Yeah, I guess I could understand.
And I didn't clean my room.
Yeah, it's an externalization of your mind.
But yeah, so I mean, I guess I could understand it a little bit more because I was 22 when he burst onto the scene. I think it was 2017, maybe. And I was at a point in my life where a lot of what he was talking about, me coming into my adulthood, it made a lot of sense, you know? So it definitely, I drew some inspiration from it. So in a sense, I'll always have respect for Peterson. But I mean, since coming back from his rehab, and I wish him well, but he's not the same guy. I mean, at least not yet. I think he's hopefully on the road to recovery, but he does not seem to have the same like intellectual horsepower that he once had.
Yeah, I wish him well. I mean, he seems to have helped a lot of people and everything. So
yeah.
I mean, I don't think I'm not one of those people who's going to hate Jordan Peterson because he's not a libertarian or an anarchist. I think that people are at different places and they need different things. It's like music. It's like, I mean, not everybody's going to listen to the same kind of music. People have different tastes and everything. People are at different points. So yeah, I mean, he seems to have helped. I know a lot of people that, you know, praise him for helping them get over a really big stumbling point or something in their life that was really bugging them. They couldn't get past. And I think that's great and everything, but I mean, he's just not for me.
Yeah. So we're over time here, but it's been a fun conversation. But Pete, so we've been doing this new segment on the podcast. I don't know if you listened to Bird's episode from a few episodes ago where we do rapid fire questions. Did you hear about Bird's segment at all?
I started listening to it, but I didn't finish it.
Okay. So at the end, we asked Bird these rapid fire questions, a lot of like magic number games, like how much would you have to be paid to do X? And one of the questions, I don't know how you're going to feel about this. I thought it was funny. So I asked it. I said, how much would you need to kick your friend Pete Quinones in the nuts? And you can't share the money with him or explain why you did it. And he goes, ooh, 50 grand. He's like, so
my nuts in case are you're worth wondering, 50 grand to Birdo.
So we'll do those in a sec. I just got a few for you, but, circling back to the funny story, talking about the Peterson impression. So I sent this video to you a few weeks ago when we made it, and I kind of like put it together in a hurry. I did a fake video or, you know, fake podcast between Jordan Peterson, Fauci and Rand Paul. Appreciate it.
I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I mean, we got great feedback. I think it's over 1,000 views, but I'm not sure where exactly. But, you know, this is actually going to be the first episode we have on YouTube. We finally have that set up and linked and everything. But as of right now, we have one clip from Scott Horton on our YouTube channel, and we have that video. And my parents are very devout Catholics. And my mom in particular is like in a group with a lot of the women. Most of them are like in their 70s and they have like these prayer groups every week. And somehow the topic of podcasts came up. Mike just called me right before we started and told me this. He goes, so apparently mom was with her church group and they got on the topic of podcasts. And my mom goes to these old ladies. She's like, oh, my sons have a podcast. And they go, oh, what is it called? And she's like, oh, it's Pulse to the Wall. They YouTube it and they go, oh, we'll have to check out these couple videos later. These 70-year-old devout, sweet Catholic ladies are going to listen to that obscene video I put together. Amazing. So
I love it.
I'm waiting for the feedback. I'm uncomfortable about it, but you just got to enjoy it. But, okay, Pete, we got a few rapid fire questions here. Okay. All right. The FBI arrests you. You're going to prison. They want to know about your background. What song do they play on repeat to get you to talk?
What song do they play on repeat to get me to talk? God. I'm sorry that I'm not being so rapid fire with this. I'm trying
to. No, it's fine.
I'm trying to remember a song that like really, really, really like became a worm. I mean,
or an artist in general.
So, I mean, I know this just ages me, but that Macarena song. I remember I was in the music industry when that came out, and it was just like people were like so head over heels, and I'm just like, oh, what is wrong with people? That should have been the first black pill.
Yeah, when the culture started to fall apart.
What libertarian podcaster do you think would do best in prison? On a related note,
I think Clint. I think Clint Russell.
I could see that. Yeah, I could see that.
I think he'd probably be running the place like in two or 3 days. Yeah.
I would ask you who would do the worst, but then that's just getting into insult territory. But you can answer if you want.
It'd be Bird. Yeah. Get him back for kicking me in the nuts.
Yeah.
Who would win in a fight between Anthony Fauci and Ann Coulter?
I got to go with Ann Coulter. First of all, Fauci's 80 and Coulter is wiry. And I bet she knows how to really wind up and throw a punch.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is a good point. We watched the roast of Rob Lowe a few days ago from Comedy Central a few years back. And Ann Coulter was on there, and it wasn't the roast of Rob Lowe. It turned into the roast of Ann Coulter, and most of it was really hacky. But yeah, I mean, she's tall. She's long. She could sting him from the outside. If you just taught her a jab, she'd be dangerous. Okay, so would you rather see your favorite band from the past live in concert or get to MC the roast of John McCain?
Oh, no, I'd rather see my favorite band from the past in concert.
And who would that be?
Metallica with Cliff Burton. Master of
Puppets. That's a good answer.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Because I saw that.
Oh, did you? What year?
86.
Wow.
I would love to see that again.
Oh, you see those pictures? Yeah, you see those pictures of Metallica from their concerts like back in the day. I mean, that it goes beyond rock star. It's like they were, I don't even know what to call that. It was like every concert looked like Woodstock. But
when I saw them, they opened up for Ozzy and half the crowd left after Metallica.
No shit.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Damn. That's impressive. But yeah, that'll do it for our rapid fire questions. So Pete, anything you want to plug before the end of the show here?
Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, my Substack by any means necessary. And on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, you can donate to me. You can become a supporting listener. Sorry to use Tom's word there. And I have Patreon, that kind of thing. And if you have Amazon Prime, there is a documentary on anarchism called The Monopoly on Violence that is on Amazon Prime. And it's free with that. It's free if you have Amazon Prime. Yep. I don't even know how much it costs if you don't. So I wasn't in charge of that. So.
How much, or just, this is a quick question we'll end on, but how have your feelings about your anarchy documentary changed over the last year, or have they? Do you stand by your work? Because it was very just educational, but how do you feel about it, a year later?
It needed to be made, and I'm glad we made it.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
I think we were the right people to make it, because we were going to keep it, we gave the best nods we could to left anarchists and, the original people and everything. But when it came down to it, it was going to be an anarcho-capitalist documentary, and having the help of the Mises Institute in doing that was, I don't know that anyone in their right mind would try to make a documentary on anarchy and not have it be centered around the Mises Institute. So.
Agreed. Right. I've watched it 2 times. It's phenomenal.
Thank you.
I always like to point people. I'm like, hey, you should check this out. If they are kind of already leaning that way, I'm like, yeah, go check this out.
We showed it at Porkfest on Thursday night at from 8 to 10. And then I did a question and answer afterwards that I don't remember being at.
Awesome.
And earlier in the day, there was a panel on documentary filmmaking. Matt Kibbe was there, and oh my God, I can't remember his name. I'm fucking it up right now. But yeah, there was, that was a lot of fun answering those questions. And I wasn't drunk yet, but I might've been a little high.
All right. Well, on that note, Pete, thanks for joining us, and we'll have to do it again sometime. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Pete.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.